Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Nearly two decades after leaving office, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright still finds herself looking at the U.S. State Department and wondering how she would navigate the extraordinary events that have unfolded since then. Her latest memoir, Hell and Other Destinations, delves into the most recent phase of her career and offers lessons that might help us make sense of the purpose of international diplomacy in chaotic times. And Secretary Albright joins us today from Washington, D.C. She needs no introduction, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, because she was the first woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of State, and she held that post from 1997 to 2001. Prior to that, she was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. And since serving as Secretary of State, she has gone on to serve other roles, ranging from business and consulting to advising the CIA. She's also written seven books, and her latest is Hell and Other Destinations, A 21st Century Memoir. Secretary Albright, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, it's very good to be with you.
So first of all, I want to start with a quotation from the book where you write, "Even today, when I read about an international crisis, I reflexively insert my name in a place in the place of the current Secretary of State and think about what I might do were I in his or her shoes." Now, of course, we are in the midst of an international crisis. So what would you do if you were Secretary of State right now?
Well, I'm very glad to be asked that. But if I had been Secretary of State in earlier this year, we wouldn't, I think, be in this particular mess. I think that what has to happen is to make clear that in order to solve this issue, we need to work with other countries, because the virus knows no borders. And what we're doing is kind of acting as though this is just something about America. And ultimately, it is the job of the Secretary of State to create functional and useful relationships with other countries, and really to put ourselves into the other country's shoes as we hope that they put themselves into our shoes. So I think cooperation is what I would be trying to get.
Okay, so practically speaking, though, what would that mean when the world was first made aware of this novel virus coming out of China? What would have been the role of diplomacy right then and there?
Well, I think, first of all, obviously to have better contact with China, I think that is one of the issues that is at question at the moment. I also think in terms of if, in fact, what had been happening in the world had been followed, then to call the countries that were experiencing the crisis and trying to find out what they had been doing or were doing. So, for instance, Korea had really done a lot of testing, and we know now had been very active, or what went wrong in Italy. And so, and then obviously to offer help, because I do think we're going to need help. So I believe that diplomatic policy is built an awful lot on knowing the country that you're dealing with, but also the relationships. And it is unclear to me how they have evolved, or when there have been meetings of groups, the G7 or the G20. How does the United States interact? And then obviously, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, the relationship with the United Nations and the World Health Organization. So I think there are an awful lot of things that need to be done. And I do think that one of the issues that has to be looked at is how many people are at the State Department or in our embassies that are able to carry all this out.
So you're talking about just the sheer person power, because, I mean, I think it's been, as perhaps you're getting to, it's been quite well reported that in the minds of many career diplomats, the State Department's been hollowed out under this administration.
Well, I find that very troubling, because the thing that I found, by the way, when you arrive at the State Department, you take over an organization where you don't know that many people, and you learn a lot about them, and you learn to respect them for their expertise and their loyalty and their to the United States and their understanding of the issues. And you really, it's not an organization or a department that's overstaffed, because most of the people are overseas. And so I think from what I read, and by the way, all I know is what I read, is that it has been hollowed out, and that there is a lack of respect for the professionals who know how to serve from one administration to another. And by the way, when I left, I thought to myself, oh, my goodness, I'm going to so miss this job, and I'm so jealous of all the people that get to stay because they are able to do foreign policy for their lifetimes. And then I thought, it's not that simple to serve different administrations, but that is part of the job, so which they are attuned to and have been attuned to. So I think that they are being discriminated against totally unfairly.
Yeah. So the thing about a virus and a pandemic is that it's a unique kind of global disaster because it's completely apolitical, right? The virus is just a virus. It doesn't have any political bent. It's not a war. It's a pandemic. So you have been inside, as a former cabinet member, you've been inside the Situation Room when presidents and their advisors have to deal with world-shaking events. I mean, what is the advice that you would have given to a president if a, you know, as we saw, a pandemic encroaching on the horizon?
Well, let me say, as I say in the book, I do teach, and I teach a lot about decision-making and descriptions of what it's like in those rooms. And part of what makes the Principals Committee of the National Security Council operate is that different secretaries are free to present what they think, what their views are. And there sometimes are arguments, and in fact, what one wants is for disagreements to be aired and to try to figure out how one can present a common proposal to the president. But I think having disagreements is actually a very important part of a decision-making process, and being afraid to have disagreements is also a downer, frankly, and doesn't help in the decision-making. So I think, had I been, I would have wanted to know where we were, what the capabilities of the United States are for dealing with it, but I would have seen it as a national security issue, because what has happened recently is that health issues have become national security issues, HIV/AIDS and Ebola, and an understanding that it takes working with other countries, and I would have advised that we are not showing off in terms of how much we know and what we're doing, but I would try to get the president and the others that would be making calls to really inquire about what had happened in the other countries and learn from their experiences. And then also, and I would hope that this would have happened, is that there would be a desire to not only share information, but to share equipment and various things that we're clear that we need. So I believe that diplomacy is about partnership. And so that is what I would have tried to expand on.
Well, I think one of the things that people are confused, if not dismayed about, is that pandemic preparedness was framed through a national security lens, right? I mean, the now infamous National Security Council's pandemic playbook, which has been which reportedly the Trump administration just failed or refused to follow. So that was there. I'm just wondering what you think now, again, circling back to the role of the Secretary of State and diplomacy, given where we are now, what should diplomacy be used for to repair the situation circa early April?
Well, I do think that there has to be an attempt, both publicly and privately, to explain, as you have just said and I said earlier, is that a virus knows no borders and doesn't really have politics. And so to try to say, we now understand the difficulty of this whole situation. We admire what you have done. We think that we can learn from you. I hope that we can figure out together how to have some kind of a bilateral approach with X country, but also one that looks at the global problem and tries to figure out, frankly, at least the following things. First of all, what, given their experiences, might happen next. And then second, to try to figure out what the tools are to deal with it. And then third, I really do think, is will there be a way to together try to figure out what the next steps are, what happens when this is over? And will it be an opportunity to obviously work together, but also think about what the institutions that are needed? I know, and I've done this myself, and I do it in my book, is compare things to World War II, and what the impetus after World War II was to create the United Nations, and to try to figure out how to deal with issues by the law and work through an international organization that is based on the nation state, but also understands the importance of cooperation.
Is the UN as it exists today, does it have the capacity to do that, to be a major and effective player in controlling a global pandemic?
Well, you know, one of the things I say now regularly, people and institutions in their 70s need a little refurbishing. And the UN is celebrating its 75th birthday, and I think it does need fixing. There's no question about it. It needs reform in a number of areas, and Secretary General Guterres has called for reform. But in order to do that, and let me just say, it has to have the support of the countries. And what I think has been lacking is American support, one, verbally, but also in terms of the bills, frankly. We are creating artificial financial problems for an institution that needs to be functional. And just as now, for instance, we're threatening not to pay, maybe the World Health Organization does need some reform, but if we don't pay, then we have no influence. And I can tell you from being there, if you are not paying your bills, you cannot have a voice in the reform. And that's what I'm concerned about.
Well, we are talking this hour with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Her new book is Hell and Other Destinations, a 21st century memoir. And we're wondering what your question for Secretary Albright is. What role do you think diplomacy should be playing right now in helping to control a global pandemic? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Her new book is Hell and Other Destinations, a 21st Century Memoir. And we're talking about her experience after she left her post as Secretary of State, and also using her expertise as a lens through which to view what role diplomacy ought to be playing right now in the midst of attempts to control a global pandemic. Now, Secretary Albright, if we could, I'd like to focus with you for a few minutes on U.S.-China relations, because it is critical, you know, even before the pandemic broke out, but now especially in the midst of it. Just, what, a week or so ago, you, along with 100 other top-level U.S. diplomats from multiple administrations, Democratic and Republican, signed a letter. And in this letter, it said, for example, quote, "No effort against the coronavirus, whether to save American lives at home or combat the disease abroad, will be successful without some degree of cooperation between the United States and China." So first of all, how would you characterize the current relationship between the U.S. and China?
Well, let me just say, to put it into a larger context, there's no question that the major powers in the world, the United States and China, is always called the rising power. And a lot of documents have been put out in terms of showing where they're going and why they're going that direction. And so no matter what, it is the responsibility of diplomats to deal in difficult situations. And so you deal with the countries that are both rising and those that are helpful and those that are not. And I think that there are a lot of questions about the response to the coronavirus, and including its initial cover-up and continuing lack of transparency and its failure to cooperate. But I do think that it's very important now to focus on how to find solutions, and they are the ones that we have to work with in terms of making moving forward in some way, and recognizing that it's a crucial relationship. And so I think blaming everything on them and also deciding that we're not going to work or coordination or having everything be a zero-sum game, I think is a mistake. And so I did sign on to that particular document, and I think that, as you pointed out, and we say that no effort against the virus will succeed without some degree of cooperation with China. And I was very interested in the fact that recently the Chinese ambassador to the United States had an op-ed in which he wrote about the importance of the relationship. And our ambassador to China, former governor of Iowa, Branstad, also wrote a letter about the need for cooperation. And that is the importance of diplomacy in all of this.
So then how would you assess, for example, the recent language that the current Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has been using? Because there is the art of diplomacy in action here. Because to your point, just last week or a little over a week ago, Secretary Pompeo made a statement in which he urged all countries to be transparent and honest as they grapple with coronavirus. That was seen as maybe a swipe at China. But then the very next day, he also said, now is not the time for the United States to consider any kind of retribution against China. It's still the time for clarity and transparency. I mean, is that an effective diplomatic dance right now?
Well, I think part of the problem, if I may say so, is kind of a contradiction in messages. I do think that what Secretary Pompeo said in that statement is appropriate, that we need to be dealing with each other. That is not the way that some of the other people in the administration talk about it. And I have to say, one of the really hard parts about what it's like to be in the government, and we do respect differences of opinion, but when, frankly, ultimately, there needs to be some kind of a coordinated message, and what's happened is that it's very hard as a citizen to follow what the messages are coming out of the task force or the president or various other people. And so I think it's troubling, though I do think that particular statement by the Secretary of State is the appropriate one.
So what I'm going to ask a two-part question here, but I'll do it one piece at a time here. Because so the statement that I read to you was just from about April 7th and 8th. Of course, before that, the secretary, along with the president as well, insisted on things such as, you know, calling it the Chinese virus or the Wuhan virus. Diplomatically speaking, what impact does that have?
I think that had a very malign in many ways, because it points up in a way of just saying that it was all their fault. It wasn't all their fault. I mean, as this particular document that I signed on to did say, that there has been a continuing lack of transparency, and to fully cooperate. But again, that the truth is, the Chinese are not innocent about everything, because they're trying to shift the blame to the United States. But I think our focus now needs to be on finding solutions. And so that is part of the art of diplomacy, is understanding what the past is, dealing with the present, and thinking about the future, and what is the way to mend the situation, to be problem solvers, not to be problem makers.
So what would that look like right now, though? Would that mean, like, is this a time for a U.S.-China summit of some kind, like a coronavirus-specific summit between Secretary Pompeo and the Chinese foreign minister?
Well, I presume they're talking to each other, and I think that part of the issue, and I do think these letters that the ambassadors wrote obviously didn't take place in a vacuum, and they are part probably of trying to figure out how to fix the relationships. We need China, and they need us, but we also need other countries to play their role in all of this, because as it's very clear that the virus is spreading into other places. So just a summit is not, you know, we don't need a lot of show. We need some real action.
So, Secretary Albright, this is I think there's a multivariate challenge here, right, diplomatically, because on the one hand, under the Trump administration, I mean, the president has been very clear about his distrust or dislike of international relationships. He has trumpeted America first from the beginning. He doesn't see a problem in the United States pulling back from the global stage. And at the same time, we have China, as you pointed out, rising. We've had China experts on this show just in the past month say that the outline of the arc they see China as following regarding coronavirus was first that paranoia and lack of transparency, which wildly exacerbated the problem. Now they've moved to, according to these China experts, Beijing categorizing itself as playing the role of global hero, for example. So diplomatically speaking, how do you handle that? In the Trump administration's defense, that is a problem that perhaps we have not, or a scenario we haven't had before.
Well, I think what's interesting, and this also requires kind of understanding what the Chinese had been doing internationally even before all this.
Right.
They have a policy of one belt, one road, of going into countries all over the world. I've been saying the Chinese must be getting fatter and fatter because the belt is getting larger. And they have gone to various countries in Africa and Latin America and offered to build roads for them or factories or basically support them. They are now, what they're doing is continuing that in terms of offering masks and various types of equipment to countries. They are being, from their perspective, very generous, and if you look at it, it can be something that obviously is needed, but it's an expansion of influence. We, in the meantime, are deciding to cut our assistance to countries as punishment for something, and are not reaching out to those that are being affected by this, not just the Chinese and the Americans, but all the other countries. And so they are using assistance as a tool of their diplomacy. And we are deliberately cutting off assistance. So I think that what's happening is we're not thinking widely enough about what I was talking about earlier, the next phase. How do we deal with this? What are our relationships going to be with other countries? And it isn't all about just the virus. It's going to be about the economies of these countries and our trade relationships and our general relationships. And the Chinese, I hate to say this, seem to be looking ahead more than we are.
Well, in fairness to the Trump administration, part of the ongoing trade battles that have been, yes, sort of enthusiastically exacerbated by the president himself, were due to things like China's really sort of questionable theft of intellectual property from the United States, things like that. So it's quite a complex situation that we have here. I'm wondering, in terms of foreign policy frameworks with which to view the U.S.-China relationship right now, is there one from history that you would look to? I mean, is this sort of a Cold War framework that we ought to apply, or what?
Well, I think this is always hard because we've talked about, even with, and we used to talk about this at various times in past administrations, is that you have to cooperate where you can and compete where you must. There are certainly problems with China in much of their behavior. I already mentioned one. The other are the kinds of things that they're doing in the South and East China Sea and kind of interfering with navigational rights. And there certainly have been problems about intellectual property and a variety of issues. But to be an active diplomat and to create a policy is to see how you do both. I would not like to see another Cold War, but I do think we need to understand that the areas that we are going to compete with the Chinese and some in which we have to cooperate. And that is what those people that have a knack for diplomacy think about. But the main part, and you return to this, is one of the hardest parts, I can tell you, just generally and just describing my life, is it's not simple to walk into the Oval Office and brief the president and tell the president what you think should be done. I happen to have worked for President Clinton, who was fascinated by what we were doing and read a lot, even assigned us books. And yet I can understand that it's not simple, given what we see. And I haven't met President Trump ever, but just watching, it must be very difficult in order to find a longer-term policy that has nuance to it and is able to balance two things, which is cooperate and compete.
Mm. You know, one of the daily themes for this program in the midst of this pandemic that we try to return to is what is the pandemic's like a mirror. It is holding up the image of who we are right now and reflecting it back to ourselves. And with that in mind, there is a particular part of your new book, Hell and Other Destinations, I wanted to ask you about, Secretary Albright, because you talk about teaching at Georgetown, and the class that you teach is called America's National Security Toolbox, right? And you write in the book that you ask your students to fundamentally ponder why countries act in the way they do. And you ask them a series of questions. So I'd actually like to ask you those questions about the United States. So first of all, you write in the book that you ask your students, what are a country's strengths and where is it vulnerable? So where would you say the United States is vulnerable right now?
Well, I think that our strengths are our people and our diversity and our economy. I think our vulnerabilities are that it is difficult to run a country of our size with various issues that are complex and trying to get agreement on them. But and then I think the vulnerabilities are basically the kind that are fixable. That's the part that but my students, I think, really see our country as I do, of one that has a great history and great potential. And so our vulnerabilities are only ones that we create ourselves by doubting, by forgetting our resiliency. And by the way, I'm often asked if I'm an optimist or a pessimist. I'm an optimist who worries a lot. And so I am concerned that we're focusing too much on that we think, and I underline that our vulnerabilities are that we don't have walls, that there are too many people coming here, that there are countries trying to exploit us. Those are not our vulnerabilities. Our strengths are that we are the most powerful country in the world that can and should have very positive relations with other countries that benefit both them and us.
Are we still the most powerful country in the world, putting our military arsenal aside? Are the other things that used to give America that power, do we still have that?
I happen to think we do. I know that we're going through a very complicated time. And also, by the way, I think that, there is the question about whether we are the most important country in the world. We are one, I believe, in partnerships, and that what makes us powerful is the fact that we have partners, allies that we can call on, and therefore when we kind of all of a sudden put them down, and feel that they are taking advantage of us, we are undermining what is one of our greatest strengths, has been our partnerships.
Well, because this leads me to another question that you ask your students. You ask them, when looking at other nations, what is that nation's self-image? So what would you, I mean, this is a complex country, but what would you say the United States' self-image is right now?
Well, by the way, I always say that diplomacy is basically putting yourself into the other country's shoes, which is why I have my students talk about five factors, you know, that are the same for every country. And one is objective, obviously, where the country's located and its resource base. Most countries don't change their location. Russia did. But our resource base is very important. But the second one is, how do the people feel? Subjective. And that is the hard part. And I think that at this moment, we are being, in some ways, beleaguered by those that tell us that we are victims. America is not a victim. And so I do think that our self-image, I would hope, is that we still see ourselves as a crucial player in the world that can determine our destiny. We are not fated to anything. We are a large, diverse country with an incredible economy and people. And by the way, what we're seeing now in all of this is the kindness of people and the hard work of those that are out there volunteering, and the nurses and all the first responders. So I think we should have a positive self-image, but not one where we think we have to dominate. That are two different things.
Well, Secretary Albright, hang on for just a moment. We have to take another quick break. We will be right back with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Her new book is Hell and Other Destinations, a 21st Century Memoir. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we will be talking with George Takei about what he calls chilling rhetoric and the rising racism that Asian Americans are experiencing in the wake of the COVID-19 global pandemic. So we want to know what you've experienced and seen. Asian American listeners, have you personally felt the impact of a rise in racism? And how have you responded? How has your community responded? Tell us your story. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are speaking with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Her new book is Hell and Other Destinations, a 21st Century Memoir. And Secretary Albright, in just a second, I'm going to let some of our listeners here. But there's one more question that you ask in that National Security Toolbox class that you teach at Georgetown University that I wanted to ask you regarding the United States, because it was a fascinating question. You ask, is a country's political system controlled from the top or driven by pressures from below? What would be your answer regarding the United States right now?
Well, thank you. I thought I'd answer it this way. I may be naive to think that in the social media age, we We might yet return to a time when observers of U.S. politics are astonished by the mutual respect shown by rivals. And part of the cost of freedom is that we are allowed to speak our minds, and yet there's no requirement that we be lucid or courteous or fair. Inevitably, some of us will fall short of those standards, but societies aren't expected to be perfect. And this is the way to answer your question. They're measured by their overall values and the distinctions most citizens make between what is or is not reasonable. So Hitler, had he begun his career in a time and place other than interwar Germany, might well have spent his entire adulthood peddling his ideas before tiny groups of drunks and Dobermans. And instead, he found millions of listeners who were so angry that they had stopped thinking and so bitter they needed but a quick shove to set sail as vessels of hate. And so for me at the moment, the question is, what kind of listeners are we? Which is why I listen to my students. And I loved asking them questions. And I think that one does have to listen and not decide that you're just going to go whatever you think is right without being a good listener.
So, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright just achieved virtually the impossible. That was from your book. You just read a small excerpt from your book. And you, in radio, we always look for people who sound like they're not reading when they're reading, who sound like they're talking. So well done, Secretary Albright.
Thank you.
But I am curious, though. The reason why, let me just push you a little bit more on this question is, okay, what kind of listeners are we? Because you could see that, in fact, it seems to me that we have two poles of pressure in the United States right now. Absolutely a political system that is heavily determined from the top. But it seems as if we've seen in 2016, 2018, and likely in 2020, the rise of discontent and pressures from below. Where did the twain meet?
Well, I think one of the issues really is, in order to be a good listener, you need to know what you're listening to.
Right.
And I think that that is what's gotten confusing, frankly. I have been somebody that has been fascinated my whole life, both as an academic and then as a political person, in the role of the media in political change. And what is happening is that it's very hard, I think, for people to know what is really going on, depending upon whom they listen to. And so I am troubled in some ways about where people get their information and how. And the important part, I think, is to listen to things you disagree with. And I'm not sure that that is being done enough because the kind of feelings are raw. We are dealing the combination. I said this earlier, actually, when I was writing my last book about fascism, but the virus issue has made it even more complicated because I happen to believe that we need to deal with scientific facts. They also are difficult to comprehend, and especially when they're being contradicted. So I think our society is being artificially divided, and I think that's what troubles me is when we go back to our image is there has been a setting of one group against another, which I think is one of the really hard parts about what's going on now.
Mm. Well, let's take a couple of calls here if we can. Let's go to Greg, who's calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Greg, you're on the air.
Hello, Secretary. I'm a recently retired Foreign Service officer. I served my first tour in Haiti in the late 90s when you were visiting on a regular basis. I'd like to know your opinion on the use of the U.S. military in a crisis like this. The Department of Defense, as opposed to, say, support for some of the U.N. agencies like WHO and the World Food Program. Thank you.
Greg, thanks for asking us, and thanks for your service. I do think that there are roles for the military in supporting a number of projects that have to do with humanitarian assistance, with trying to deal with health issues, because the military is very good in terms of being organized. I did go to Haiti quite a lot, where we were part of an international operation. And I do think that there is a role in conjunction with the State Department and the Justice Department and others, mainly because of their capabilities in getting out into the field and being and helping.
Let's go. Greg, thank you, by the way, for that call. Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Secretary. Yes, I have a... It appears that the world has seen the greatest, most powerful country on earth brought to its knees by this virus. And that kind of relate to our vision, our influence, our direction for the world is dramatically diminishing. In particular, how our president, the present administration has talked down, has degraded a lot of these leaders and these countries. Now, we know that China has been going around the world over the past 30 years, monopolizing all the natural resources. Now, this based on personal protection equipment that we were struggling to get. What's going to be the next? What is our real vulnerabilities? I mean, we haven't really discussed our vulnerability states. I mean, What's next? What's going to be the next event that's going to bring us to our knees again?
Right.
And
Ray,
can we handle that?
Ray, thank you so much for that question. Secretary Albright, do you have an answer for him?
Thank you. I do think that as a result of a rather peculiar policy decisions that have taken place recently and a blindness, we are looking as though we have vulnerabilities. We are a country that can get our act together with our leaders who are democratically elected, who listen to their people, and who deal with facts. And so I believe that we have strengths when, in fact, we cooperate with the scientific community, with the various structures in our system of governors working with the federal government, and then I think using the capabilities that we have, we can't be jealous of China, which is an autocracy where they hide the facts and they don't have transparency. And so I think we need to really make a big point about our strengths, which is democracy, transparency, and obeying the rule of law. But we have to make sure that our leaders are doing that.
So in the last couple of minutes we have, Secretary Albright, you know, we've obviously been focusing a lot on U.S. foreign policy and, for example, bilateral diplomacy between the United States and China. But the truth is that this pandemic has also struck at a time where hyper-nationalism is not unique to the United States. It has risen in many countries across the world, making any kind of multilateral cooperation, even in the midst of a crisis that, you know, all of humanity is dealing with, that much more difficult. So what role is that playing, and how can we get past it? How can we break through the nationalistic impulses waving around, washing over the world right now for the betterment of all humanity?
Well, I do touch this on in the book because I really am concerned about exactly that. Globalization is a statement of fact. I mean, we are all interconnected, and we have seen it even obviously before the virus, but it now is very evident. But partially what has happened is that it's faceless. People want to know what their identities are, and that is very appropriate. But when that morphs into hyper-nationalism, where people think they are the right and everybody else is wrong, and then there is a leader who takes advantage of it to take complete control, and I've written about Hungary, for instance, as a perfect example of that. Where the leader all of a sudden, Orban, is operating by decree. And therefore, I think what has to happen is we need to think more about the values of democracy and having people empowered and voting and making decisions and not being taken advantage of by hyper-nationalism. And that's why I'm so troubled when the President of the United States goes to the United Nations and all he does is talk about how important we are, and nationalism without considering, and it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure this out, is that we cannot exist in the 21st century if we do not have respectful relationships with other countries, and respectful means you can tell it like it is to them without berating them and thinking that you are the one that has all the answers. So we're at a very, very difficult point, and I'm hoping, frankly, that I know it's a cliche, that we take advantage of this crisis in order to figure out what kind of a world we want to live in the 21st century, where the United States is respected and acts as a partner, and the American people have a chance to do what we've been doing, is have to have free and fair elections and be able to know what the truth is, tell the truth, and be proud. And I have been asked to describe myself recently in 6 words. I say, worried optimist, problem solver, grateful American.
Well, Madeleine Albright is the former United States Secretary of State. Her latest book is Hell and Other Destinations, a 21st Century Memoir. Secretary Albright, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Well, we're going to wrap up this hour by turning to Jack Beatty. He is On Point's news analyst, and he joins us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So what do you make of Secretary Albright's call there for the possibilities that could come about through this crisis?
Well, that remains to be seen. What I'm struck with is how her most famous phrase, that America is the, quote, indispensable nation, how that now seems a fossil phrase. Writing about it in her memoir of 20 years ago, Madam Secretary, she said, "My purpose in using the phrase was not to put down others, but rather to stir a sense of pride and responsibility among Americans so that we be less reluctant to take on problems." Well, since then, we have taken on problems in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Syria. No doubt I've left out others. And the result is, looking at American foreign policy just a few years ago, Robert Kagan wrote, "The old consensus about America's role as of upholder of global security has collapsed in both parties. We have gone from America as the indispensable nation to the Trumpian view of American first." And that reflects a change in public opinion, a dramatic change. Recently, a focus group of people about talking about foreign policy, only one in the focus group, a large focus group, could even say what the liberal international order meant. These phrases, increasingly to Americans, are seen through Trumpian eyes as devices to, steal American treasure. And Trump has put his stamp, it seems to me, at least for the time being, on a minimalist view of American foreign policy, and increasingly the view of the United States as indispensable belongs to history.
Well, so perhaps a minimalist external view of the United States, but the president is advocating for his take on a maximalist internal view. And perhaps that's not necessarily unique to President Trump. I think there, amongst many American voters, Jack, of both parties, there was a sense that America's sort of primacy on the world stage and the way foreign policy was executed, where money and resources went, came at the cost of the American people and their own well-being. There is something to that. I mean, my question is, can we imagine a nation that retains that primacy on the world stage while also attending to the needs of its people here at home?
Well, one problem is just simply seeing reality. Polls have shown increasingly that without doubt, that the public sees foreign aid as representing 25% of the national budget, the government's budget. In fact, it's less than 1%. So, first of all, people need to understand we're not being all that generous. But on the other hand, we have 800 bases in 70 countries, which are, more than Britain, France, or Russia have combined. We're still this great imperial power, and Americans increasingly say, what's in it for me? And, you know, when you look at NATO, when you look at the disparity in funding for that and so on, which Mr. Trump has made a big issue of, and then you look at what our place in NATO has made possible for Europeans. What always got me was the 5 weeks that a German laborer could spend in a spa. Boy, that's great. Americans can't do that. Denmark spends the proportion of GDP that we spend on defense on retraining workers. Imagine if we did that. So increasingly, as Americans look out over this 800 bases in 70 countries, with Joseph Chamberlain, the turn-of-the-century English foreign minister, they might say, the weary Titan staggers under the too vast orb of his fate. That's America.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Jack, thank you as always.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Melissa Egan, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Grace Tatter, Adam Waller, and Sydney Wertheim. Our co-captains are Graham Griffith and Jeb Sharp. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.